Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 14, for May 28th, 2008. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I'm happy to have you with me as always. This is a special edition of the Brainy Gamer podcast, special for a couple of reasons. First of all, I've got a terrific interview, and the podcast is almost entirely devoted this time to an interview that I have, and I'll talk about that in a second. The other reason it's special is because I'm recording at this moment from my car, and the reason is because right now the house is in a state of chaos. We are having an air conditioner put in, and my original plan was to go ahead and, you know, move upstairs, and there's a room that I typically record in where my computer is, and you know, the guys putting in the air conditioning are in the basement, so I figured it wouldn't be too much, you know, noise, and I could, you know, mention there might be a little noise and it wouldn't bother anybody. But just at the moment the guys arrived with the air conditioner, this huge truck pulls up in front of our house, and the neighbors next door are having this huge tree trimmed, and these guys are in, you know, one of those big arm buckets, you know, that swing around, and with chainsaws, and they're basically taking this tree down to about a third of its of its size. So it's just incredibly noisy, and it's important to me for all kinds of reasons to get the podcast out today. I need to get the podcast out, so I've kind of had to make a couple of changes to my original plan, which is actually fine, because my interview today is really the central focus of this podcast. My guest in this episode is Steve Gaynor. Steve is a game designer who works for 2K Marin, and in case that doesn't ring a bell with you, 2K Marin is the studio formed by 2K Games to make the next BioShock game. And Steve is also a blogger. He writes a blog called Fulbright, which I've been following since I started blogging, and actually before that. He's one of the most insightful bloggers I know, partly because he combines this wide-ranging set of interests that he brings with him to the process of talking about game design. And the lion's share of what we talk about in the interview is game design stuff. And I just couldn't be more happy that he was willing to talk to me and also spend so much time really focused in a pretty comprehensive way on issues related to designing games, and really in some ways proposing a new way of thinking about game design that really gets at the question of how to design interactive experiences for people that get at, you know, things that have more relationship to our everyday lives. There are, you know, in some ways kind of three or four basic narrative paradigms that games stick to in and out year after year. And I think part of what Steve's interested in is asking, you know, the fundamental question: can games tell other kinds of stories? Can games get at other parts of our lives that matter to us, that are significant to us, that aren't always just about space marines and drug lords and science fiction soap operas? So that's part of the interview. Also, you'll find accompanying the posting of this podcast on my blog a link to Steve's site, where he is issuing a call to arms, which is a request for gamers and people who are interested in games to propose game design ideas that get at some of the new ways of thinking about games. He touches on that a little bit in the interview, but you can find out much more about it on his site, and I'll link to it on my blog. So that really is the podcast today. I'm just going to do this little opening and then kind of launch right into it. And I'm not going to add my regular two or three segments around the interview, partly because the interview really is the focal point of what I want to do in this podcast, but also because I've kind of been knocked off my game for a variety of reasons, which I already explained. But trust me, when you hear the interview with Steve, I think you'll find that there's more than enough content in this podcast to make up for anything that I might have said in any of my own segments. Steve is really a brilliant guy, and I really think you're going to enjoy this interview. So enjoy the podcast, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks. I just got Wii Fit this morning. It's sitting in its box, and I'm sure I'll talk about that. It's weird, you know, with these guys running around the house, my wife and I sort of looked at the box and we thought, you know, should we get the game out and take a look at it? And we both sort of agreed that we were too self-conscious with these guys running around that, you know, to sort of get on the balance board and start doing yoga positions. It just didn't seem like very appealing to us. So we're going to wait till they leave, probably tonight sometime after we put the baby to bed. We'll jump on that balance beam, and I'm sure I'll start gathering up some impressions that I'll report on in my next podcast, and a whole slew of games that I've been playing. It's kind of a backlog of games that I haven't discussed on the podcast. I've given some attention to on the blog, but I'll return with some more impressions and commentary about certain games that I've been playing that I hope you'll be interested in. So enjoy the interview, and thanks for listening. I want to welcome Steve Gaynor to the podcast. Steve is a friend that I've known for a short time, but a fun time. We spoke and met at GDC in San Francisco, and before that, I grew to really be a big fan of his blog, Fulbright. He's not as regular a blogger these days as he used to be, because he's very busy working at 2K Marin. For 2K Games, working on the next BioShock game. So Steve can't talk about that game, of course. You probably understand why, but I have a whole bunch of other questions that I want to ask him, and he's graciously agreed to spend some time with me. So Steve, welcome to the podcast, and thanks again for doing this.
Oh, hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
I'm interested in basically how you got started as a game designer, and you know, maybe just a little background about where you came from. I get a lot of questions, and they really shouldn't be directed at me from my blog and readers. You know, how do I get into games? How do I do this? And, you know, I'm just a guy who teaches at the college level. I don't teach game design or anything. What was your path, and how would you describe, you know, the way you kind of got to where you are today?
Well, I mean, I got in a way that a lot of people that I've known have, which put most simply is through QA. I was a tester for a year and a half. You know, that experience was only indirectly to my actually becoming a designer. My actual paid design career started after making amateur maps for first-person shooters and stuff, so it was a self-made portfolio that led into my first design position. Mm-hmm. But I'll go back and do this chronologically so it makes a little more sense. I went to a state college, but I was in an art program, and I had done a lot of illustration and writing of comics and stuff like that. And I was completing my sculpture degree, and I just kind of realized over time that all of my notebooks that I was keeping started going from being like story ideas and stuff like that, just sort of morphing into video game ideas and design related stuff. And I just kind of noticed this. It was sort of out of my control. I was just like, oh, look, all these ideas are about video games now. And I realized that I was really interested in how these things worked. And, you know, I acknowledged, yes, this is sort of the form of media that speaks the most to me. And why is it interesting to me? And how can I get involved? I realized, okay, what I want to do is make games. And obviously what I'm interested in is design, because that's what all my writing is. So I got to the point of realizing, well, one way in is to, you know, make levels and become a level designer. And then through being a level designer, there's possibilities for becoming a system designer and et cetera, et cetera. So as I was finishing college, I started digging in and finding a free level editor online that I wanted to make levels with, because I knew I wanted to make single player levels. I wanted to make sort of triple A game kind of levels. So I tried editors for like Splinter Cell and Unreal and a number of, and Half-Life and everything. As I was finishing college, I realized, well, I discovered, you know, I really like this game, Fear, which came out as a first-person shooter. And Monolith Studios was gracious enough to release for free the editor for Fear and all the single-player assets. And so I went about starting to make some levels for that. And concurrently, I started Fulbright, which was originally just a level design workbook. It was like, here's the progress I've made on the levels that I'm building. Check it out. I made a box and put a light in it. Isn't that exciting? And so I finished college as I was learning to make levels on my own time, just with these free tools for a game I'd bought at retail. And eventually, I found TimeGate Studios down in Texas, who were making expansions for Fear. And I happened to be making levels for Fear, which I showed them. And they were like, well, you already know how to do the job we want to pay you for. So why don't you move down to Texas and make levels for Perseus Mandate, the second expansion pack for Fear.
And what did you major in college?
That was part of the long searching period where I started as an English major, and then I was going to be an illustration major, and I finally decided, you know, I had done drawing for so long that I wanted to push myself and see what's like to work in a three-dimensional space, which I'd never really done. So I finally transferred to a sculpture major and graduated with a sculpture degree and an art history minor.
Interesting. And I've found when I've spoken to designers that there often is this kind of crazy circuitous path that people take. There doesn't seem to be one way of getting there. You know, art major, English major, film major, you know, people who have a writing background. There doesn't seem at this point anyway to be a very clear path that people sort of obviously need to take. Is that still true? Is that changing?
I think you could say that it may be changing in some circumstances. It's changing. I mean, I worked with guys at TimeGate who had gotten game design degrees from the Guildhall at SMU,
right,
I believe.
Right.
But, you know, that, like, for instance, the guys I'm working with now at 2K, one of them, I don't know what they got their degrees in, but one of them started as a games journalist and then was a writer at a studio and went on to move into design. Another guy started out as an artist and transferred his skills over. And I think our lead designer was a tester and then a producer and then a designer. So, yeah, you know, I think that it's pretty common, at least currently, and maybe this will change as schooling becomes sort of the way to get in.
Yeah.
But at least currently, yeah, it's just sort of people, I think, who, much like myself, I think, were doing something, whatever it was, a liberal arts thing or, you know, doing like a different discipline like art or programming, and they just kind of became unintentionally drawn into design because it's what was, you know, pulling on them for whatever reason.
It's funny because I came across an interesting quote from Ken Levine on how he thought about BioShock as he was working on it, you know, sort of what his background was. And I think I got this from IGN or GameSpot or some interview that he'd done, but he says, I have my useless liberal arts degree. So I read stuff from Ayn Rand and George Orwell and all the sort of utopian and dystopian writings of the 20th century, which he found fascinating. And and he sort of, you know, called on some of those useless liberal arts experiences. And I resonate with it because, you know, I mean, obviously I teach liberal arts students and we tell them that we're sort of equipping them to go in all possible directions. And it's nice when that occasionally turns out to be true.
Yeah. I mean, when I was an art student, I was in a program that at least by the end, I knew it was not a program I was pursuing to apply to an actual vocation. Like, I'm taking a sculpture course because I want to be a sculptor. I knew that wasn't the case, but I have to say that the stuff that got me jobs and, you know, got me any job, like, you know, whether it was freelancing for the local paper, whether it was my first design job, all of that came from work I did on my own time outside of school that was completely unrelated to school. you know, there's so many times that I think back to film courses or art history courses that I took while I was in school, and just how they give you jumping off points for understanding the world in a different way.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think even though none of that is necessarily, unless you're in certain fields like academia or criticism or whatnot, even if it doesn't apply directly to your job, I'm not, you know, like when I'm scripting an encounter in a video game level, I'm not really drawing from has been incredibly enriching to someone like myself, especially who's creating entertainment that needs to resonate with people who have been exposed to all this other pop culture and classical culture.
Well, it's interesting because when I read your blog, everything is kind of underpinned by an interest in film, an interest in popular culture, an interest in comics, an interest in obviously in video games. You weave together some really interesting threads from your own personal interest. And I mean, it has to somehow inform your approach to designing things, to thinking about how things should be built, how things communicate meaning. I mean, it seems to me pretty obvious that you've make those connections on a kind of regular basis in your mind, but also in terms of what you work on, what you produce.
Yeah. You know, there are two sides to that. One thing is like that, I think as far as my blog goes, the reason that I draw from these other pieces of media and other sources is just a natural side effect of being obsessed with something to the point of when you're consuming any given film or book or whatever, it's seen through the lens of my subconscious is thinking about video games. So anything that I consume is on some level related to something about how games work. So that's sort of accidental. But you know, the other side of it is sometimes your kind of liberal arts education does have tangible uses, and it's because I think it allows you to, with other people who have been exposed to this stuff, it allows you to have a common ground for discussion of ideas and pushing concepts in different directions. We were interviewing someone for a level architect position at 2K Marin the other day, and they're the people who actually build the levels, create the geometry, and do the art and everything. And he referenced the Panopticon, which is, maybe you know of it, it's sort of a philosophical, theoretical piece of architecture that was devised by sort of a philosopher in the 18th century, and eventually some examples of it were actually built centuries later. And just the idea that he was like, oh, there's this, you know, sort of, there's one architectural form that I'm thinking of. And I'm like, oh, the Panopticon, I know what you mean. Yeah, it's laid out like this. That would be really useful. Having a common vocabulary, I think, comes out of that kind of liberal arts background.
Something else that may come from that, and, you know, help me if I'm sort of putting the pieces together in the wrong way, but you wrote recently on your blog, and we traded emails about this because it really affected me in a certain kind of way. You titled this blog post Credo, and it really read to me like a kind of an artistic statement, or, you know, in the old days we used to call these manifestos. You were talking about, among other things, genre. And in terms of design, and I'm just going to sort of recount a couple of the points you made, and then I'm wondering if you might kind of comment on what you were thinking and how this came to be in your mind. You say, reject genre. Genre is repetition. Genre is not design. It is mimicry. Genre is safety. It is copying proven mechanics as a method of risk mitigation, which is an interesting phrase. And relying on genre is reiterating the experiences of an established archetype. You're saying deconstruct genre, repurpose it, use it to your own ends. That's a really interesting take on genre. I mean, genre is in some ways kind of inescapable if you're making things, you know, that are going to have some sort of popular appeal. But your take on it really interested me, and I'm just kind of wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure, and you know, it's possible that, well, I think it's probable that my particular kind of examination of genre is geared pretty specifically towards video games, or at least that's a lens through which I was looking at it. It's the idea that genre isn't necessarily determined by what happens on screen as far as what the characters are doing per se. Like genre, at least in my estimation, in film can arise more from setting and from cinematographic style and sort of the director's take on the events on screen. But, you know, if you look at film noir, there's a lot more to noir than Private Eyes and, you know, Dangerous Dames and
Shafts of Light, Shadow.
The fedora hats and stuff. A lot of it is about attitude. You know, you look at The Third Man versus Double Indemnity versus Sunset Boulevard, and they're all noir, but they have nothing in common as far as plot and largely in terms of characters or sort of what their characters' motivations are in a lot of cases. But in games, I feel like genre is almost the opposite. A game genre is determined by what the player actually does via his character, regardless of setting. You know, and if you look at something like a first-person shooter, you can look at Doom or Half-Life or No One Lives Forever or Bioshock, and the settings, the narratives, the background, the visual styles are all absolutely unrelated to one another. But the core experience is of a one-man army running around a 3D space, killing dozens or hundreds of kind of cannon fodder enemies. And regardless of how you reframe that, if you stick to a very kind of genre-reliant FPS formula, you're always going to express deep down, I'm the one dude that runs around with a lot of guns and kills multiple people every minute, you know?
Right.
Which I think is a unique form of genre that as far as, you know, video games compared to other media. And so I feel like one of the things that I'm most attracted to in video games is that they can directly relate an experience and the feeling that's derived from participating in that experience to the player. You know, you give the player the tools of interactivity and they are reliving the experience that you've set up, even if it's through one degree of remove, you know, because you're not actually doing it, but you're controlling an avatar as directly as possible to perform these acts that result in a feeling, an aesthetic response. And so that is my problem with genre and games, is that if you stick to genre and games, you're expressing the same experience repeatedly. And especially like late generation games, instead of, you know, if for instance, a game, well, let's go with this. Let's go with a different thing because I know this is the case. Okay. So Gears of War, was heavily influenced by, Cliff Bleszinski during development, going out and playing paintball and saying, you know, paintball is about getting behind cover and popping out and snapping off shots of people and working with your team to advance. And I wanted to work that experience into Gears of War. So I started working on the cover dynamic and it transformed that game. Games that follow that sort of commercial release, instead of expressing a personal experience that one of the designers had, they're expressing the experience of playing Gears of War. And so I feel like it does the medium injustice if you put all this work and time, instead of attempting to express something unique and personal to yourself through an activity, you're expressing the experience of playing another video game that you really liked or that was profitable or whatever motivation you have for it.
It's interesting because it seems like in video games to me, there's very little separation usually between genre and formula. Genre almost becomes formula, that there's a certain set formula for doing something that becomes sort of the thing you do, as opposed to, say, film, where, you know, you can work within a genre, but you can ring changes on that. You can play within it in a certain way because we kind of understand how that works. And like you say, you can make three different, radically different films all within the same genre. But with video games, it seems like genre is very determined by a sort of set of very specific formula.
Well, I think sort of just part and parcel of how the medium works, because if you look at the MDA framework, which I've linked to in my blog and which I got turned on to by Clint Hawking and his work, and then the games the game development, the game design workshop at GDC and everything.
I'll link to that on my blog too. So it's probably something that a few people know about, but not many.
Right. And so if you look at that, it's a way of deconstructing how games work in saying that the base elements of any game experience are the mechanics, the individual sort of rules of the game, if it were a board game or a sport or whatever, such as in a first-person shooter, I can run around and I can shoot my gun, and when I shoot my gun, you know, a line is drawn out of it, and if it intersects an enemy, he takes damage, and if I do enough damage to him, he dies, and I win. The sort of resulting moment-to-moment player experience of that is expressed through dynamics, which arise from the individual mechanics working in concert. So, you know, that it's the idea that, okay, if you take these mechanics of a first-person shooter, which are run, shoot, kill enemies, add in more mechanics such as the enemies understand each other's positions, enemies understand the player's position, they can tell when they have line of sight on the player or not, and they'll try to gain line of sight on the player by circumnavigating obstacles and stuff. You end up having the dynamic experience of squad tactics, right? So enemies work together. You have to sort of understand how the mechanics lead to these emergent dynamics of, oh, now these two enemies are working together to try to, you know, flank me or root me out of my position. This is interesting because I have to think of what the implications of the individual mechanics are going to be and process that through how I'm going to play the game.
Right.
Which in the end leads to an aesthetic response. The aesthetic response in that case probably being maybe fear or surprise or just sort of an adrenaline rush of working against a superior force, and elation upon victory when you've overcome superior numbers and you know, been the victor. So the point is that if you maintain a consistent set of mechanics, unless you alter or rearrange them in an extremely significant way, in all likelihood you'll arrive at slight variations on the resulting dynamics, and again, similarly, slight variations on the resulting aesthetic, which can be, you know, influenced somewhat by surface elements, artifice like setting, characters, dialogue, you know, the sort of authored stuff. The City of Rapture and the character of Andrew Ryan make that experience a lot different from playing Halo, for instance. But in the end, because you've stuck to the mechanics of run around, shoot your gun, it hits guys, they die, regardless of how you try to change it, you're going to get to a similar end because you started at a similar place.
Right.
I think that's kind of insurmountable just as far as how games work, which speaks to why you need to, if you want to give people a unique experience, an experience that's personal to yourself, you have to reject the idea of mimicking an established set of mechanics, because if you do, you're going to, the results are going to be something that you're already familiar with, that you've played before.
Now with BioShock though, I mean, it does seem like there's another element in play there, which is this elusive kind of thing, you know, choice, consequences, things like that, where it's, you could call it an aesthetic response, but it seems like there's an ethical dimension to it, that there's an attempt to try to sort of suggest that if I do this, I need to think about how I feel about doing this before I do it. And then after I do it, I'm going to have consequences that may have an effect on me emotionally or mentally or whatever. I mean, that's also stirred into the mix, isn't it?
It is. I think it's only really effective if the mechanics support it. And in the case of BioShock, and Jonathan Blow, for instance, has talked about this, and you may have seen the graph online that shows the mechanical outcome of your moral choice of saving or harvesting the little sister characters that you encounter throughout the game.
Yeah. Right.
And if you're very invested in the artifice, in, you know, the voice acting and the character models and all that kind of stuff, it can be impactful to you. But as you play the game, mechanically, there are no repercussions to that decision. The opposing forces in that conflict are supposed to be altruism versus self-interest. And in BioShock, you ended up with the exact same resource payout, or maybe even better resource payout, if you acted quote-unquote altruistic, and saved all of the little sisters. And so, you know, that is sort of a disingenuous mechanical proposition when you say, all right, through the story, we're telling you one thing. Through the actual rules of the game, we're really telling you something else. And I think that there is much more potential.
Yeah, of course, that's what I want to talk about. I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I know you can't talk about BioShock 2, but I mean, I think that that's what really, this is where we're all looking, it seems to me. Is it possible to take the next step? Because BioShock really kind of opens a door, it seems to me, to those of us who've been playing games for a long time, and you can sort of peek through it, and you don't really get to go through that door like you suggest, but we sure did get a good peek at what's on the other side of that. And I think it, you know, that's got to be at least half of the excitement about BioShock 2. And I know you can't talk about it, but it has to be, you know, are they going to be able to go through that door?
Right. I'm very curious. And that's part of why I'm excited to be working at 2K Marin and on specifically a follow-up to BioShock, because BioShock is an outstanding game. I've said something not 100% complimentary about it just a moment ago, but overall, it does so many things that are interesting and great. You know, between the actual tuning of the existing mechanics and the gameplay, the way that narrative is woven into the world through the audio logs and stuff, Ken Levine's wonderful writing of all the dialogue in the game, the art, et cetera, et cetera. It's a wonderful platform, and there are also things that could obviously be improved, which is a great place to be at, right? Yeah. we're early enough that even if you did ask me, how are you going to address all those things? I don't know. we'll see. I'll find out along with everybody else on the design team and at 2K. I think that part of the reason that sort of the mechanical contract wasn't fulfilled in BioShock 1 is that following through logically on the conflict between altruism and self-interest in the context that they put it forth, it would result in a fairly punishing set of game mechanics or you know, dynamics that would arise, because if you were truly altruistic, you would be resource starved because you would get no payout for saving the little girls.
Right.
And that is really difficult in a mainstream video game, right? Where it is at odds with the core mechanics of a first person shooter, which say this game is about empowerment and validation and the ability to be powerful and win and, you know, clear levels and beat guys and feel good about yourself. And so if you quote unquote do the right thing, and your mechanical payout is you get nothing and the game gets harder and you don't have any, you know, genetic powers to attack enemies with, I think that that at least as far as I'm aware, the thought during the development of the original game is that, so on the one hand, yeah, it may have resulted in a more enjoyable or sort of palatable game experience for most players, but was it the most effective expression of altruism versus self-interest via an interactive game system? I would say no, but you know, where is that line drawn? Is it something that you can do in the face of millions of players? I'm not entirely sure. That's something that we're going to have to wrestle with in the coming months.
I'm curious, boy, there's like a million things I'd like to ask you about that, but I'm going to move on because I have a few other things I want to get to. The whole question of does a game have to be fun in the sense, you know, that we think of fun, like rewarding the player and, you know, giving them cookies for when they accomplish things, you know, that's a whole separate question, but maybe we can talk about this some other time.
Sure.
I'm curious to know about working at a new studio. 2K Marin is a brand new studio kind of added to the 2K fold of 2K Boston, 2K Australia. I'm just curious for those people who, you know, wonder what it would be like to work at a studio that's kind of just being launched and kind of on the ground floor of a brand new game. What's it like? Can you describe what the experience is like, or kind of what your first couple of weeks were like when you started?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for one thing, you know, building a team involves a lot of interviews and a lot of hiring. So everybody who's good at making video games, please apply immediately. If you've been enjoying this interview, you could talk to me again if you apply for a design position. It's very interesting, and it's exciting for me. I mean, the team that's there is sort of a splinter cell of the 2K Boston team, who transferred over to the West Coast to start 2K Marin to build the sequel to BioShock, and they're great. They're just flat out. Everybody that came over from Boston and everybody that they've hired since that I've worked with is just incredibly professional and driven and experts in their field. Just awesome work on their discipline. You know, the stuff that we've been putting together, it blows me away every day. Even though I'm rather inexperienced, and I was one of the newest, on my first day, obviously I was the newest guy on the team. They embraced, you know, my work and my involvement right away. You know, the first day I was in on a phone interview with a designer we were talking to, and I've been able to contribute to the stuff we're working on in what I feel is a meaningful way, just right from the get-go. You know, I got off the mark and started doing stuff that we've seen a lot of progress on. So, you know, it's exciting to go to a morning meeting and have, you know, our executive producer, Alyssa Finley, announce, hey, we gave an offer to that programmer or that artist that we were talking to the other week, and he's accepted. He's going to start in a couple weeks, you know. And it's like, hey, another new face on the team, you know. We're gonna get there. We're going to have a full squad before long, be able to knock this thing out. So being part of a studio on the rise is it's a cool experience. It is.
I want to ask you, and this will be the last big question I ask you, and then I'm going to ask you in a second about whether you have a Last Supper game that you would choose as the final game that you would play if you had one last game to play ever. So you can get that bubbling around in your mind a little bit.
Yeah.
You probably already know I'm going to ask you about this. You wrote a piece on your blog a while back, and this got huge traffic for you, I'm sure. You know, it's a tremendous amount of attention. I think you wrote this back in February.
Yeah.
It was called Wager. Yeah. And everybody from, you know, N. Guy Kroll to the Rock, Paper, Shotgun guys and, you know, Borat Pfeiffer and various other people, you know, big bloggers, big game writers, kind of all responded to this piece that you wrote. And in this piece, basically you said, the wager was this: I'll bet you that video games will never become a significant form of cultural discourse the way that novels and film have. I'll bet you that 50 years from now, they'll be just as mature and well-respected as comic books are today. So that was in February, and you got a lot of commentary on that piece. I'm wondering if you're still willing to make that wager. Have you changed your mind about that in any way, or do you still kind of stick to that point of view?
All right, so it hasn't been that long since February, and I can't say that that my mind has changed much in time yet, but half of it is a hypothetical. You know, me playing the devil's advocate and arguing one side of how I see video games today, and the other half of it is true and is really how I feel, and is we as game developers will pigeonhole ourselves into only creating certain kinds of experiences that are aimed at people with certain interests that only speak to, you know, the demographics or the audience that we currently enjoy, and that through that we'll become irrelevant. When in actuality, I see so much potential for games to speak to anyone who comes into contact with them. Just by conveying experience directly through interactivity, whatever that is. And I think that the danger is that we don't consider, and maybe we don't fund, if we want to look at the commercial side of it, experiences that lie outside of our current comfort zone, whether it's developers and designers and people like myself pitching ideas in the first place, or whether it's backers and advertisers and retailers wanting to put money behind unproven ideas, whatever it is, I feel like, you know, we need to have the bravery, if you will, to branch out and to try and say, well, what is a personal experience that I've had that that maybe no one else has had quite the way I've had it, and how can I allow other people to experience that through an interactive product that I've designed? What is something new that I can say through this medium, right? And, you know, going back to the genre thing, if the majority of what we're doing is repeating the experiences we've had in other video games, then I feel it's just going to be a downward spiral. And I think if you look at even the current day Japanese game industry and gaming audience, I've read plenty of Japanese game developers talk about how they deal with gamer drift and how their existing audience is dwindling and dwindling. And how, you know, except for Nintendo with their more casual products that are branching out to new users, it's hard to continue as a game developer aimed at the Japanese audience in Japan, because, you know, they have tilled the same soil too many times with, you know, established concepts of like the Japanese RPG with the sort of cookie cutter cast of characters and the reliable set of mechanics that players in large have outgrown it or gotten bored with it or moved on to other things that are more engaging because they can say new things to them. I want us to be able to say new things. That's my main concern.
Yeah. To what degree are we tethered to a medium that had its roots in games for kids, that video games sort of from their infancy, or at least early on in that period where people got to know what video games were, that immediate association was that's what kids do. They play these fun games. And other media haven't had to try to emerge from that kind of, that kind of cultural understanding. Is that a part of it, do you think?
It is something that I touched on in that article, and I feel like it's a hurdle that is unique to games in comparison to some other specific media. I mean, they'd be seen as frivolous entertainment, but they weren't, as far as I'm aware, seen as something for children, right? They didn't have the maturity problem with them. Maybe they just had sort of the what you would now call they were caught in a culture war between low entertainment and high entertainment.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to talk about games as art because art is too subjective to say anything is or isn't. I can't take it. But what you mentioned, I think, is an issue, and I think it's one of the big parallels with comics, is that comics and games both started out as very insubstantial distractions for kids. They're both trying to mature, you know, and appeal to older people and more diverse people, but I think maybe they both tried to or are trying to mature in the same ways. And I feel like, and this will draw the ire of Western comics lovers, but as someone who loves what is great about comics myself, I still feel like they reached a cultural dead end in a lot of ways. Like, not to say that they haven't helped bolster the cultural relevance of film as a dialogue by giving all of their valuable ideas to filmmakers and letting film be more important and more profitable based on their work. But I don't, you know, I think that games have so much potential that I want us to be about more than never getting further than superheroes and super soldiers and fantasy heroes and science fiction, whatever you want to talk about. Again, not ragging on science fiction, but there is more to life, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because I mean, culturally, if you think about Hollywood and the cinema as this kind of big super highway with, you know, like you're suggesting, you know, comics have become this kind of, you know, feeder road leading in, you know, and it's this tiny little road with a very limited fan base, and it gets funneled into this mainstream thing, and then of course they become huge, but they become huge because the language that the cinema uses, the ways that the cinema appeals, the ways that the cinema dumbs down, the way depending on how you want to describe this. I mean, yeah. And of course, video games. Well, there's going to be a BioShock movie, isn't there?
There is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Pirates of BioShock, possibly. Pirates of City.
Yeah, I wondered. You know what the people at 2K must be. You know, the shorthand they're using to refer to this.
It's it's so early. We have a couple of names, and the fact that it's in early production, it could be awesome. It could be not. You know, only time will tell. I'll go see it.
Yeah, well, and we'll see. And at least you do hear sometimes you hear that a certain thing is being made into a movie, and just shake your head and you're like, what the hell were they thinking? But a BioShock movie. I mean, it could be brilliant. I mean, it could be spectacularly good, it seems to me. Or, the alternative.
I think if anyone, since as far as I'm aware, Ken Levine wrote almost every word that was spoken in the original BioShock, to his credit, he created a world and a cast of characters along with his fellow designers that people found really intriguing and that, folks in Hollywood thought was an interesting enough set of ideas to bring into their medium, and more power to everyone involved.
Absolutely. And I mean, I want to be back in that place. I mean, that beyond the storytelling and beyond the mechanics and the plasmids and all the other stuff, it was just being in that world was such an extraordinary experience.
It's an incredible place, and it's founded on ideas and sort of the high level meta dialogue is about things that people don't usually talk about in games, whether it's idealism versus realism or altruism versus self-interest. There was a lot of interesting thought floating around in that game. And one of my favorite things about it is that so many games, whether they're Western or Japanese, wherever they come from, are so kind of without identity. They're fairly whitewashed, mm-hmm. In the sense of, they seem to come from a generic place, but a fairly generic place. And one of the things I loved about BioShock was how much culture, and I don't mean that in the sense of like artistic culture, but actual world culture, different regional personalities and backgrounds were represented in that game. There was an enormous amount of Jewish characters in the game who were clearly Jewish and worked, elements of Jewish traditional culture into their speech, depending on sort of how closely they were tied to that world. It was great for me to see a game that was so obviously influenced by a specific tradition or set of beliefs or group of people, as opposed to sort of just the standard, I'm generic dude who runs around with a gun. I'm the guy that, it doesn't matter where I come from. Let's go shoot some aliens together, It's like, I can actually tell this person is from Russia and was in a concentration camp, and this family kind of, clearly has an accent that shows they come from this part of the world, or, there's that really distressing log of the two player, the two characters who were parents who their daughter was turned into a little sister, and they had seen the little sister that day, and by the time you find them, they had committed suicide together. Yeah. And they refer to the big dad, the mother is the one talking, and she refers to the big daddy as a golem. And it's a tiny reference to sort of where those characters came from in their lives. They're wonderful kind of artifacts to see woven into a game like that.
I was impressed. Yeah, very impressive. And the environments have their own story to tell, which is also fabulous.
Yeah. You can read sort of tableaus of past actions just by walking through the world in a lot of places, which is interesting. So.
Well, I'm sure that, I'm one of zillions of people who are hoping that this BioShock 2 game will be out as soon as possible. I know it's not it's like late 2009 that it's announced, and I hope that you guys make that deadline, because we're all pretty excited about it. I would imagine almost everybody listening to this is going to want to play that game.
I'm more worried about how it turns out once we do get it to the shelves, but I'll try not to let anybody down.
Well, I always end these interviews with a question, and I'll ask you the question now, and it is, what would be your Last Supper game, the last game that you would play if you knew that it would be the only game, the final game that you could play in your life? What would that game be?
Okay, so this isn't the question of, if it was your last day on Earth, what game would you play?
Well, no. Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've got a couple of people have written me to say, you know, like this Last Supper thing, it's a very Judeo-Christian thing, isn't it? I mean, could you like not be so... I'm like, okay, I get that. I understand that. And I didn't think of it like that. Like, it never really occurred to me that I was making a biblical reference or anything. But I'm just trying to now suggest that it's the last game you would play if you knew that games would be taken away from you forever.
Okay. All right. Because it's a much more kind of grim vision to say, I know this is my last day on Earth. At midnight, you know, the chariot is going to turn into a pumpkin and it's over for me. I think I'll just sit down and play a goddamn video game.
It is pretty lame, isn't it? I know Corvus Elrod, I think he was one of my first interviews, you know, just because he knew he was going to die, he'd actually given thought to, you know, he wanted to do Wind Waker because, you know, it reminded him of his childhood. And, you know, as he's there about to be turned into Soylent Green or something, he wanted to be able to remember his childhood through Wind Waker. I was like, wow. I guess how I ask the question really does have a pretty big impact on the game.
Yeah. Because, man, like, you know, I'm as in love with games as anybody else, but if I knew the end was near, I would probably just think back fondly on games I had played and then do something else with my last few hours. No offense to any video game super fans who would not agree with me, but
that makes sense to me. We'll rephrase it to whatever way that works best for you.
So if an EMP bomb was going off and video games weren't going to exist in my life ever again, I think that I would play the LucasArts adventure Sam and Max Hit the Road. Yeah. And part of that, you know, part of that is just because it's a great game, for one thing. It's the writing and the presentation work beautifully together. It's hilarious, you know, it's incredibly funny, and it has an enormous amount of heart to it. The one thing I love about it is that it expresses the idea of an actual friendship, like, in a really recognizable, sort of believable, palpable way, that I recognize these two characters as being, you know, kind of dear friends of one another, even though they're, you know, slapstick cartoon animals and wacky things happen to them. The way they relate, it feels so genuine to me that that's an incredible aspect of the game. And, you know, I've played through it a dozen times, so I would be able to go from one end of it to the other in a few hours without getting stuck, so that'd be nice.
They are like old friends, though. I mean, they really are like old friends. There's a definite kind of Abbott and Costello vibe with them, too. You know, there's a nice kind of vaudeville through line that you could draw from kind of old-style comedy all the way through to them.
Yeah, and, you know, when you said that initially, when my mind processed what you were saying as, those old adventure games are like old friends, like revisiting them. And, you know, in a way, it's true, because they're always going to be the same. they're always sort of one foot follows the other, and you're going to go from the beginning to the end, and they're a story with, you know, these warm characters that you remember, and it's going to be sort of a comfortable experience. And in a way, it is kind of like being with an old friend, maybe that you haven't visited for a long time. Yeah. Yeah, the other half of it is personal, just because it was one of the early kind of adventure games that I played, following like Maniac Mansion and the Sierra Adventures, that helped pull me and kind of cement me as someone who followed video games, and, you know, that they were important to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've played through it so many times. It introduced me to independent comics, because you know, the creator of Sam and Max, Steve Purcell, the game was based on comics of his, which I bought the book of and read through and through over and over, and followed more comics from there. And when I was in my early teens when I was first hanging out with my girlfriend Rachel, who I'm still with. We played through that game together and laughed along with it. And I remember being at her family's house and you know, just going through this experience that I was familiar with, being able to share it with her, and that we just had a night. You know, it's a youthful memory for me, and it's definitely something that if I were going to hang it up, I would have that experience one more time before I put it away.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, thank you very much, Steve. You've been really gracious with your time, and I've really enjoyed this conversation a lot. And thanks for thanks
for making great. Time.
And best of luck to you at 2K Marin, and I hope that you continue to find that whole process rewarding, and that you find the designers that you need to make this game and get it to us as soon as possible.
I'll try not to rush it, but yeah, I'm as I can, even though it's not as easy now that I'm not working from home anymore, and I have to find the time. But I'm planning to do a sort of audience participation post as my next thing, and get some more bloggers and writers involved in this idea that I have for a series of posts about game design and stuff. So look for that when you get a chance.
Great, will do, and I'll cross post it on my blog so people will know about it. Because I'm glad you're working with 2K Marin, but I miss Fulbright and I miss your regular posts. So you're doing the right thing. Keep making the games, but you know, if you come back and do the blogger thing, that would be great too.
Hey, I'm gonna keep it up. I won't drop it. Okay. I promise.
Well, thanks a lot, Steve.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you, Michael.
Okay, take care.
That's it for the podcast. I want to thank Steve Gaynor for joining me, and I want to thank all of you for listening, as always. If you have a moment to go over to iTunes and post a comment on my podcast, I'd be most grateful for that. I will be back in a couple of weeks. Until then, see you next time.